Secretary of State Antony Blinken says Israel must be at the table for talks on a post-war Gaza.
If you build that integration, if you bring Israel in, if you make the necessary commitments to security, and you move down the path to a Palestinian state, that's the single best way.
Plus, the International Court of Justice hears evidence as Israel is accused of genocide.
There are ongoing reports of crimes against humanity and war crimes being committed, as well as reports that acts meeting the threshold of genocide.
And later, Israel has found hostages' DNA in tunnels through civilian neighborhoods, and an underground school is being built in Kharkiv amid Russian shelling. Plus, a look ahead to Davos. Today is Thursday, January 11th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's tour of the Middle East is continuing on Thursday. He's in Cairo, where he said that any plan for a post-war Gaza and a Palestinian state must include Israeli buy-in.
If you pursue the first path, if you build that integration, if you bring Israel in, if you make the necessary commitments to security, and you move down the path to a Palestinian state, that's the single best way to isolate, to marginalize Iran and the proxies that are making so much trouble for us and for pretty much everyone else in the region. And I think that vision is very clear to many of the leaders that we talk to in the region.
And speaking of diplomacy, on Wednesday, the UN Security Council demanded that the Houthis in Yemen immediately stop attacks on ships in the Red Sea. They cautioned against escalating tensions while implicitly endorsing a U.S.-led task force that's been defending vessels there. Reuters' Gabe Singer has that story.
The UN Security Council on Wednesday demanded Yemen's Houthis immediately end attacks on ships in the Red Sea. That came via a Security Council resolution, which also called on the Houthis to release the Galaxy Leader. It's a Japanese-operated ship linked to an Israeli businessman that the group commandeered last November. The UNSC also demanded the vessel's 25-person crew be freed. 11 members of the council voted for the measure, while 4, including veto-wielding Russia and China, abstained. None voted against. Linda Thomas Greenfield is the U.S. ambassador to the UN.
The threat to navigational rights and freedoms in the Red Sea is a global challenge that necessitates a global response.
Wednesday's measure includes an implicit endorsement of a U.S.-led task force called Operation Prosperity Guardian that has been defending commercial ships in the Red Sea and other areas from Houthi attacks. The attacks have disrupted maritime commerce and led some shipping lines to take longer routes to avoid the Red Sea, which could increase energy and food prices. The Houthis are an Iran-lined group that seized much of Yemen in a civil war and have vowed to attack ships linked to Israel or bound for Israeli ports to show support for Hamas Islamists battling an Israeli offensive in Gaza. However, many of the targeted ships have no links to Israel. A Houthi spokesman dismissed the UN resolution as a, quote, political game and said the U.S. was the one violating international law.
That's Gabe Singer of Reuters reporting for us. And in other UN news, the UN's International Court of Justice is holding hearings Thursday and Friday to decide whether an interim measure needs to be brought against Israel to try to halt the war in Gaza. Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg explains the history behind the South African government's longstanding solidarity with the Palestinian people.
South Africa has gone to the ICJ, or International Court of Justice in The Hague, charging that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. On Thursday and Friday, the court will hear arguments from both sides and will then decide whether to issue an interim order that Israel stop its bombardment of Gaza. Clayson Monyela, spokesman for South Africa's Department of International Relations and Cooperation, explains why South Africa has taken this route.
There are ongoing reports of crimes against humanity and war crimes being committed, as well as reports that acts meeting the threshold of genocide or related crimes, as defined in the 1948 Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide, have been and may still be committed in the context of the ongoing massacres in Gaza.
South Africa and Israel are both signatories to the convention, Legal experts say the full case to prove Israel is guilty of genocide could take years, but the hearings this week are an urgent measure to seek a quick order against Israel in the meantime. If South Africa wins at what is often dubbed the World Court, it will be an international embarrassment for Israel, lawyers told VOA this week. However, while decisions by the court are binding, they are not always followed. Russia, for example, has still not obeyed a 2022 ICJ order that it halt its invasion of Ukraine. Mia Swart, a visiting international law professor at South Africa's University of the Witwatersrand, explains.
Enforcement is typically the Achilles heel of international justice at the ICJ. It's probably highly likely that Israel will not, immediately desist from all military action should the court order this, and that this will then have to go to the Security Council.
As a permanent member of the top UN body, the US has veto powers and is a firm ally of Israel. Washington, like the Israeli government, has called the South African lawsuit meritless. South Africa's support for the Palestinian cause is long-standing, says Gerhard Kemp, a South African law professor at the University of the West of England, Bristol.
There's also an historic reason for this. The African National Congress, the governing party of South Africa, has a very long-standing relationship with the people of Palestine, with the Palestinian liberation movements. So therefore, there's also historical significance in that South Africa is taking the lead on this by bringing Israel to the ICJ.
The African National Congress, or ANC, was itself once a banned liberation movement that led an armed struggle against the racist white apartheid regime in South Africa, and says it sees echoes of that in the plight of the Palestinians. Former South African President Nelson Mandela was a close friend of former Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and famously said South Africa's freedom would not be complete until the Palestinians were also free. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Meanwhile, as Israel defends itself against charges of genocide at the ICJ, the Israeli military made public what it says is proof that Hamas kept hostages in tunnels underneath civilian areas. The AP's Ben Thomas has the story.
The Israeli military says it's found traces of hostages in an underground tunnel in Gaza. I'm Ben Thomas with the latest. Khan Yunis, in the southern half of the Gaza Strip, has become a focus of Israel's ground offensive, and the military has been showing journalists tunnels in the city, where it says it's found signs of the hostages. IDF spokesman Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari.
We found in this tunnel hostage remains, hostage DNA. Hostages were held here in this tunnel system.
Hagari stood in front of a corrugated tin hut that covered the tunnel's entrance in a residential yard, a plush but weathered couch nearby. He says Hamas militants retreated to Khan Yunis immediately after their October 7 attacks.
Embed themselves in the civilian neighborhood in order to make it impossible for the IDF, unless he does a ground operation, to fire at this area or try to rescue the hostages in this area.
Several freed hostages have described being held inside tunnels. The IDF did not say if the hostages whose DNA had been identified are known to be dead or alive. I'm Ben Thomas.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A look ahead to the World Economic Forum. That's in a few minutes here on the show. Now, though, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is visiting Estonia on Thursday as part of his Baltic countries tour. And the first underground school is under construction in Kharkiv. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
The President of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, continues his tour of the Baltic countries. On Thursday, after visiting Lithuania, Zelensky and Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba arrived in the Estonian capital Tallinn. Estonian Foreign Minister Margus Tsahkna wrote in X that Estonia gives a strong signal and assurance to Ukraine that the country firmly stands by Ukraine's side. In Tallinn, President Zelensky held a meeting with the President of Estonia, Alar Karis, and Prime Minister Kaja Kallas. During a joint press conference with President Karis, Zelensky answered a question about a potential pause on the Russia-Ukraine battlefield. He said,
"A pause on the battlefield in the territory of Ukraine is not a pause in the war.
This does not mean that it is an end to the war and does not lead to a political dialogue with the Russian Federation or anyone else. This pause will only help the Russian Federation. Why? Because we understand the volumes, how much of what they are producing today. We know how much drones and artillery they produce per day. And we see what they are lacking, and that they have a big deficit with drones and with artillery. Big deficit. With missiles, too.
Zelensky called the first foreign visits in 2024 to the Baltic states the visits of gratitude, mutual confidence of nations which are bordering Russia, and a demonstration of unity. Meanwhile, the city center of Kharkiv was under massive Russian shelling again on Tuesday evening. The Russian forces hit civilian buildings in Kharkiv and the area near a hotel in the very heart of the city. As a result of the attack, at least 13 people were injured, including two foreign journalists. The cleanup of debris continues. Also in Kharkiv, the constant attacks by Russia require additional improvements to the city's civil security. The mayor of Kharkiv, Ihor Terekhov, posted a video on Wednesday demonstrating the construction of the first underground school in the city. He confirmed that all concrete structures have already been assembled and works on waterproofing, thermal insulation, sewerage, water supply, and ventilation are ongoing. It is expected that in March, children will be able to begin their studies on the premises of this school, and the city will start building the next school in another district. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And nearby, on the north side of the Baltic Sea, Finland's interior minister confirmed on Thursday that his nation will extend the closure of its border with Russia. Jeff Custer has the story.
Finland closed its border with Russia late last year in response to a growing inflow of asylum seekers, which it said was an orchestrated move by Moscow, a claim which the Kremlin denies. The border had been scheduled to reopen January 15th. But at a news conference in Helsinki Thursday, Finnish Interior Minister Mari Rantanen told reporters it is absolutely necessary to continue closing the eastern border, as authorities say the threat of Russia's influence still exists. The Finnish Border Guard reports some 900 asylum seekers from nations such as Kenya, Morocco, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen entered Finland from Russia in November. The Border Guard said that was an increase from less than one per day previously. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
Has the West missed the best opportunity to help Ukraine? To find out, I'm joined by Yaroslav Trovimov. He's the chief foreign affairs correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. His new book is called Our Enemies Will Vanish: The Russian Invasion and Ukraine's War of Independence.
You know, from the very beginning of the war, the Russian President Putin has been making threats about employing nuclear weapons and retaliating against any Western assistance to Ukraine. And that really tempered, initially, American and other Western help and sort of kept forcing self-imposed self-deterrence, if you will, you know, self-imposed restraints throughout the conflict. So when Ukraine asked for Western heavy weapons, and Western-made planes and tanks in the beginning of the war, this was turned down because it was seen as provocative, as leading to escalation. And in the spring of 2022, when Ukraine again kept asking for this equipment, it was denied, or it was supplied initially in limited quantities, first the artillery, then came the HIMARS. But it took more than a year for Western-made tanks and fighting vehicles for the Patriot air defense batteries to come to Ukraine, and F-16s are still not delivered. You know, the Ukrainians are just now training how to operate Western aircraft. And the paradox of the war is that at the time when these weapons would have been the most efficient, the most useful, when Russia was at its weakest, before it mobilized forces, before it started digging defense fortifications. And here I'm talking about August, September, October 2022, that all that equipment was not provided. And when it eventually came in large numbers the following years, it was sort of too late, because the Russians had already mobilized hundreds of thousands of troops and had created these obstacles that the Ukrainian military was unable to cross in its spring offensive.
Well, hindsight is always 20/20. Can you really blame the United States or other Western countries for doing what they did when they thought they were avoiding a nuclear war?
Well, it's not about the blame game, right? It's about how you calculate your risks. And you know, think about nuclear escalation is that you never know. So there is always this threat. And as far as Ukraine was concerned, well, they're already being obliterated. They're already being at war. And as Zelensky kept telling Western leaders, you know, the Russians have already used everything except for the nukes in Ukraine. So as it has proven to be the case, you know, the Russian nuclear threats were, you know, a bluff. And Russia actually was... if you will, acting rationally. But there was this fear, and you know, if you are a foreign policy actor, if you're trying to draft your defense policy, you have to calculate how much of that risk you're willing to take to achieve your goals. And in hindsight, you know, a lot more could have been done without crossing the threshold.
Your op-ed in the Washington Post is part of a larger book about the war between Ukraine and Russia, and it's a wonderfully written narrative, kind of going back and forth between the different places, the different people at the times. How did you get all of this information? Where were you when this was happening? How did you come to know all of these facts?
Well, you know, I was in Ukraine since January 2022. I happened to have been born in Ukraine, though I lived abroad for most of my life, and I spent my entire journalistic career covering wars and insurgencies in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other places. And so it was very different to cover a war in my own home country when the city where I was born was being bombed. And on the other hand, speaking the languages and knowing the culture, knowing the people there, it was much easier to go around and meet officials, meet commanders, go to the front lines, witness firsthand much of that conflict. And so the book is in large part based on personal observations in the year, in the first year of the war, and many, many more trips after that. But I also wasn't in Ukraine all the time, so I've got to come to talk to politicians and leaders and decision makers in the West as well who were involved in this conflict.
So as journalists, we try to detach ourselves from the situation to remain objective. How can you remain objective when it's your homeland that you see being destroyed?
It's a very good question. And I think if it were another war, it would be much more of a challenge. But if you look at the war in Ukraine compared to many other conflicts since World War II, I'm hard-pressed to find a conflict that has greater moral clarity. You know, Ukraine was invaded from one day to another without posing any threat to Russia. And it's as cases of clear-cut, unprovoked aggression go, that's probably, you know, one of the most clear ones.
Yaroslav Travimov is the chief foreign affairs correspondent at the Wall Street Journal. His recent op-ed appeared in the Washington Post. He's also the author of Our Enemies Will Vanish, The Russian Invasion and Ukraine's War of Independence. Mr. Travimov, thanks so much for spending the time with us today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
And now to Central Africa, where the Congo River has risen to its highest level in more than 60 years. It's causing flooding throughout the Democratic Republic of Congo and the Congo Republic. Reuters' Alice Rizzo has more.
Residents in Democratic Republic of Congo use shovels to paddle their way through flooded streets, now clogged with discarded plastic bottles and other debris. The Congo River has risen to its highest level in more than 60 years and has caused flooding throughout Democratic Republic of Congo and neighboring Congo Republic. More than 300 people have died and 300,000 households have been affected over the past month, with tens of thousands of houses destroyed, authorities said. Climate activist Ketia Pasu.
As an activist, I'm not very surprised to see that the water level is rising so much. What surprises me is the extent to which no measures are being taken for all those families who are just suffering the effects of climate change in the form of heavy flooding.
Ferry Mowa, a hydrology specialist at the DRC Riverways Authority, said his office had flagged the high water level in late December, warning that almost the entire floodplain of the capital Kinshasa could be affected. On Wednesday, the river reached over 20 feet above sea level, just shy of the 1961 record, he told Reuters. Several neighborhoods in DRC's densely populated Kinshasa have flooded, as well as communities in more than a dozen provinces, the Social Affairs Ministry said. Kinshasa resident Juansin Lukula says the government doesn't take responsibility for the situation.
You get the impression that people are left to their own devices, building wherever they want, however they want. There's no urbanization. There's nothing being done. There are no gutters planned. And even if there are gutters, they are not maintained.
DRC's Social and Humanitarian Affairs Minister, Modeste Mutinga, told Reuters that a meeting will be held on Thursday to evaluate further humanitarian aid.
It's Alice Rizzo of Reuters reporting for us today. And finally, more than 60 world leaders will join hundreds of business executives and campaigners at the Swiss ski resort of Davos for the five-day annual meeting of the World Economic Forum. It starts on Monday. They'll discuss some of the biggest global challenges, including the impact of disinformation worldwide. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Delegates gathering in Davos for the annual meeting of the World Economic Forum are faced with a daunting range of global challenges. Worsening conflicts, worsening climate change, a weak global economy, fears over artificial intelligence, attacks on commercial shipping in the Red Sea. In its report published Wednesday, the summit organisers said disinformation is the biggest short-term risk. Carolina Clint from Marsh McLellan Risk Consultancy is a co-author of the report.
The potential impact on elections worldwide over the next 2 years is significant, and that could lead to elected governments' legitimacy being put in question. And this in turn could, of course, threaten democratic processes, lead to further social polarization, riots, strikes, or even intrastate violence.
The summit takes place against the backdrop of two major wars in Ukraine and Gaza. Among those due in Davos are the Israeli President Isaac Herzog, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, Chinese Premier Li Qiang, and US Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Alongside political leaders will be hundreds of the world's most powerful chief executives. Critics say their wealth has increased while billions are getting poorer. Nabil Ahmed is from the aid agency Oxfam International.
Across the world, people are feeling extraordinary hardship. And at the same time, you know, there's a few sprinting off at the very top into the distance, and some of them will be in Davos. And it is, yes, a space for dialogue, for important discussions, even for holding political and business leaders to account. It's why organizations like Oxfam take part. But it's also not an international democratic space in which, you know, transparent, accountable decisions are being made.
Summit organizers say it's vital to bring together political and business leaders to find solutions to the world's myriad challenges. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
And that ends today's program. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.